Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Kagan. In tonight's show, women and the golden age of travel. A tomb with a view, the stories and glories of graveyards. Political controversy in Dublin Corporation in the second half of the 19th century. And then to end the show, we'll be talking to Eunan O'Halpin about the life, death and legacy of Kevin Barry. Last week we looked at the life and work of the Roman poet Horace and discovered how his odes became some of the most influential poems in world history. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show with maiden voyages. After World War I, a world of opportunity was opening for women. Before convenient air travel, transatlantic travel was the province of the great ocean liners, and never more so than in the glory days of the interwar years. It was an extraordinary undertaking made by many women. Some travelled for leisure, some for work, others to find a new life, marriage, to reinvent themselves, or find new opportunities. Their stories have remained largely untold until now. And they're told in a brilliant new book by Shan Evans. It's called Maiden Voyages, Women and the Golden Age of Transatlantic Travel. It's published in hardback by Two Roads and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. And Shan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. What a lovely introduction.
So how did this book come about? Because there's a fascinating family connection that you have to some of these great ocean journeys of the past.
Well, it is a family connection indeed. I was born in Wales and I grew up in Cardiff. My mother's family were called Roberts and the Gronos. They were from West Wales. They lived around Fishguard and St. David's, in Pembrokeshire. And many of the menfolk in the family went to sea, including my own grandfather, George Roberts. Now, my grandfather, George, had an uncle, Stephen Grono. He joined Cunard and he became the chief officer on the Aquitania in 1914. Aquitania was Cunard's most impressive vessel. And it was launched in the summer of 1914. And during the Great War, Stephen Grono, he was made the master of a Cunard-owned cargo ship, the Vinovia. And in December 1917, he was sailing back from New York when the Vinovia was torpedoed by a German U-boat in the English Channel. He survived, although nine of his crew were killed. He fought for 4 hours to try and get the ship into the shore to try and save the cargo of brass, but the ship sank underneath him. Amazingly enough, he survived the night and was recovered, was rescued the next morning, unconscious and suffering from hypothermia, but floating, attached to a bit of wreckage, attached to which was the ship's bell, and that's how the rescuers found him. So they got him home, dried him out, and warmed him up again, and back he went to work for Cunard. I became fascinated by George Grono's story because my cousin who lives down in Pembrokeshire, was looking into his life, and I started researching it myself, and I started looking at the history of the Aquitania.
And while researching that, you discovered that ships like the Aquitania were designed specifically to appeal to female passengers, and it opened up a whole world of discovery looking at both the women who worked on these ships and the women who travelled on them.
That was exactly so, yes, because looking at Stephen Grono's experience on the Aquitania, I went to the Cunard Archives in the University of Liverpool in the special collections there. And what I found there was evidence that the ship had been designed specifically to appeal to women. The Aquitania was on the drawing board and was halfway through construction in 1912 when the Titanic sank. The Titanic sank, of course, because it didn't have a double hull and because there weren't enough lifeboats. And so it's a massive disaster, as you might imagine. It put off a lot of people from travelling, and particularly female travellers, even though women, survived the sinking of the Titanic far more so than men numerically. But what it proved to me was that the Aquitania was then redesigned by Cunard with this problem in mind, by making out that the ship resembled on the inside almost a vast floating country house. And they employed a designer called Arthur Davis, who had previously worked on the Ritz Hotel in London, to give off this impression that the ship was safe and that it was comfortable and that women in particular would enjoy the travel.
And you've mentioned there the Titanic. There's the remarkable story in the book of Violet Jessop, who survived the sinking of the Titanic. But she also survived a number of other maritime disasters. So she had quite an extraordinary career.
Violet Jessop is a wonderful character. She was born in 1887 in Argentina to Irish parents, Catherine Kelly and William Jessop, both of whom I think came from Dublin. And she was the eldest of about six kids. And her father died when she was quite young. And she ended up going to work at sea as a stewardess because they needed to keep the family afloat, as it were, financially. She became a stewardess. She was incredibly naive. She really didn't understand that the reason all these men on board being so charming to her was for a somewhat ulterior motive. At least she didn't at first. Anyway, she one of her early journeys, in 1911, she was working on the Olympic when it collided with another vessel, which was quite obviously a nasty experience. In 1912, she survived the sinking of the Titanic because she was instructed by one of the crew to get into a lifeboat to show the reluctant passengers how easy it was. And she was set afloat along with the other people in the lifeboat. And she survived amazingly, was picked up by the Carpathia the next morning. And then in 1916, she was on the HMS Britannic, which was the third of these three ill-fated sister ships to be built in Harland and Wolff in Belfast. She was on board the Britannic, which was a hospital ship sailing through the Mediterranean, when it hit a mine. And it hit a mine at the prow end, and that started to sink downwards. And the rear end, with the propellers still churning, started to come out of the water. And as all the crew took to the lifeboats, what they didn't realise was they were being inexorably dragged into the wake of these churning propellers. And people were just chopped to pieces, as you can imagine. Violet was horribly injured. Her boat turned over. She went down underneath the boat. She sustained a fractured skull and a bad leg injury. And she bobbed to the surface, and she was saved, fortunately, by one of the ship's engineers who was in the same vicinity as her. Amazingly enough, despite all this, she went back to sea, and she's put in 43 years as a stewardess. She earned the sobriquet, the unsinkable stewardess, richly deserved.
Richly deserved. Another fascinating woman in the book is Josephine Baker. Tell us about her and about her journey, and then I suppose how she left America and became this great star and celebrity in Paris.
Well, Josephine Baker was born in, I think, 1906 in St. Louis, Missouri. She was black. She came from a very poor background. She was sent out to work to be a housemaid at the age of seven or eight and was cruelly mistreated by her employer. She managed to escape to New York, and she taught herself. She was entirely self-taught as a dancer. She would dance for nickels and dimes outside theatres, and she was talent spotted. And she was put on the stage in Harlem, and she was talent spotted there again and recruited for a show that was being put on in Paris called La Revue Nègre, which is entirely black musicians and dancers and performers. So she travelled the Atlantic on the Majestic, arrived in Paris, started to perform, and instantly became a massive hit in Paris. The Colour Bar, such as it was a very different situation in France in those days. Paris in particular was very liberal, particularly sort of the artistic and the performance and the showbiz side of things. And she became a total sensation. I mean, you know, Picasso adored her. Ernest Hemingway wrote about her. She modelled for Man Ray. She became an extremely wealthy and successful performer in her own right, in a way that could never have possibly happened to her in her own home country.
Now, here's a controversial one for you, because there'll be certain people who would have wished that she never made the journey to New York in 1930, and then others, especially in America, some who would celebrate it. Mary Ann McLeod, tell us about her and also her children.
Mary Ann McLeod is a fascinating character. She was she grew up in a place called Tongue, which is near Stornoway on the Isle of Lewis. She was the 10th child of a family of impoverished crofters. She had a couple of older sisters, one of whom got pregnant out of wedlock. And of course, that was a great disgrace in those days. And Catherine, I think she was called, she had the baby, and the baby was sort of absorbed into the McLeod family. And so Mary Ann McLeod, who was the youngest, was 8 years old when this little girl was born, played with this small child and got to know her very well, and obviously had a lot to do with her. Catherine, unable to find a husband because, of course, she was tainted goods, in the words of the era, decided to light out for America. She went to New York. She met and married an English butler and did very well working out there. And two more of her young sisters went out to join her. In 1930, Mary Ann McLeod, the youngest, was 17 years old, and she realised that, life in a Scottish, you know, remote community was very depressed. There was no income. There was no way in which she was going to make a living. And, of course, they had a real shortage of menfolk since the Great War, and because of a particular maritime disaster there, the sinking of a ship with 280 returning soldiers on it. So she thought the best thing she could do was go and join her sisters in New York. So she scraped together £10. She got as far as Glasgow, and she embarked on a ship in 1930 for New York City, stating that she intended to be a domestic worker. In other words, she was an economic migrant. She was going to New York to seek her fortune. Shortly after she arrived, with her one of her sisters, she went to a party and she met a thrusting young real estate developer called Friedrich Christ Trump. And reader, she married him. And they had five children, the fourth of whom, Donald Trump, was born in 1946. Now, if you believe the what-if school of history, then if Mary Ann McLeod had stayed in Scotland, perhaps Donald Trump might not be the person that he is and was.
Oh, a fascinating thing to consider. Ooh. Now, let's talk about what it was like on these voyages in the Golden Age. How luxurious and glamorous was it if you were rich enough to be able to travel first class? And how bad was it if you had to travel in steerage?
Well, that's a very good question. Each of these ships, of course, was like a city in and of itself. It was like an enclosed city. Once it set sail, it had to be self-sufficient in terms of expertise, labour, supplies, goods, everything, fuel, the whole works. Your experience of a transatlantic trip in, let's say, 1920 would be entirely dependent on how much money you had and where you were in the ship, where you were in the ship's hierarchy, either as a passenger or as someone working on the ship. Now, if you were in first class, you can imagine the ship was almost like, you could take a slice through a ship, it'd be like taking a slice through a gatto. On the very top is the sort of the cream. The very uppermost floors, decks of the ship were inhabited by the staterooms and the great public spaces for first class passengers. These people were typically monarchs, millionaires, celebrities, people who were pretty damn wealthy. And therefore, they had great suites of rooms. They might have several bedrooms. They'd have a couple of little rooms for their own staff. They'd have their own private dining room. They might have a balcony, and so forth. And these rooms would be very beautifully appointed, usually in sort of historicist styles up until about the mid-1920s. They tended to favour old-fashioned, traditional-looking styles. Again, the country house image. If you were in the middle ranks, if you're in the second class, they were literally on the decks below. You'd have a smaller room, a cabin. You'd probably have a little dining room or a little sitting room attached to it. Your beds might be smaller, bunk beds. It would still look pretty much like a decent hotel, you know, a smallish hotel room. And you'd be dining in your own dining room, communally, with other second class passengers. Now, further down the ship, literally above the waterline, just and sort of symbolically above the cargo, were the third-class passengers. They travelled in a category which had been known as steerage, which up until about the Edwardian era was usually dreadful. Very little ventilation. They were packed in tight in bunks. Each bunk had about 100 cubic feet, which isn't very much. It's like 10 foot by 4 foot by 2 foot, something like that, of space. They'd have a wire bed base. They'd have a very thin mattress stuffed with straw or seaweed. If they hadn't brought their own pillow, they'd have to improvise. They would only get one blanket apiece. So everyone would travel wearing all their clothes, both for modesty and so things wouldn't get stolen from them. And of course, the North Atlantic is a very, very rough place. And down by the waterline, you could really suffer badly from seasickness. And of course, this is also an era before the age of indoor plumbing. So as you might imagine, conditions over a 7 or 10 day voyage Steerage did improve with third class. So the bigger ships tended to go in for rather more basic but perfectly functional, rather utilitarian cabin-style accommodation by about the time of the First World War. And it gradually got better into the 1920s. But it's still, your experience of ocean travel would very much depend on where you were in the giant sort of social pecking order, the hierarchy that was very, very apparent on these ships.
Well, it's an absolutely brilliant story that you tell, Shan, and I think we'd all love to have another golden age of travel. And until that comes to pass, I think we can spend many enjoyable hours travelling in the company of some of these remarkable women in the book. Congratulations on the book, Shan.
Thank you so much, Patrick. A delight to talk to you.
The book is called Maiden Voyages, Women and the Golden Age of Transatlantic Travel. It's published in hardback by Two Roads and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. An absolutely wonderful read. And I think something that when we're all staying at home, I think it's a tonic for the soul. Shan Evans is the author. And Shan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. So who are London's outcast dead, and why is David Bowie their guardian angel? Well, the answer is in a new book which uncovers the stories and glories of graveyards. And it's a book for anyone who has ever wandered through a field of crooked headstones and wondered about the lives and deaths of those who lie beneath. The book is called A Tomb with a View, The Stories and Glories of Graveyards. It's published in hardback by Headline and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Peter Ross. And Peter, you're very welcome to the show.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
It's a fascinating book. Can I ask you, what inspires you to explore these graves and graveyards?
Well, a couple of things. I've always been fascinated by these places ever since I was a little boy. I used to spend whole summers in an old cemetery in Stirling in Scotland, where I grew up. And I really learned to read and write in that place, in a sense, because I remember kind of wandering around and sort of sounding out the unfamiliar words on the headstones, like unto and remembrance. And also spending time wondering about the lives and deaths of the people buried there. And that gives you a great interest in character and narrative. So I think in a way that made me a writer too. But then much more recently, since I've been living in the south side of Glasgow, there's a cemetery on the hill behind my house. It's called Cathcart Cemetery. And when we first moved to this house, I was walking in there one day and I saw a headstone, a very simple pink granite headstone. And on it was written the words, Mark Sheridan, comedian, and that he had died in 1918. And I wondered, I'd never seen anything like that before, and I wondered, who was this guy? So I began to look into his life, and it turned out that Mark Sheridan was a music hall star from the northeast of England, and he is the reason that we all know the song, I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. It was the popularity of his 1909 recording of that song that made it almost like a kind of folk song now. And I wondered, how did that man that sang that song come to be buried on the hill behind my house? And it turned out very sadly that he'd actually taken his own life while on tour in Glasgow. And it was really from there that the book grew, because I thought, well, there must be stories like that everywhere across Britain and Ireland and elsewhere. And that was really the acorn of the book for me.
So tell me, who are London's outcast dead? And tell me about the connection with David Bowie.
Yeah, well, London's outcast dead are remembered in a place called the Crossbones Graveyard. Now, this is a sort of small patch of ground in Southwark in London, just near London Bridge, just in the shadow of the Shard. And in the medieval period, this was the place where the sex workers of London were laid to rest. They weren't allowed to be buried in consecrated ground, and so they and their children were buried in this unconsecrated patch of ground. And then later, as the centuries passed, it became a burial ground for poor people. That part of London during the Victorian period was almost the poorest part of the city at that time. And so the poor of London would be buried there. And so traditionally, it's been a place where those that have been sort of marginalised have been laid to rest. And much more recently, in the last couple of decades, it's almost become a place where people who feel themselves to be on the fringes of things can go and sort of celebrate their own oddness, but also remember their own loved ones and lost ones. And there's a kind of vigil held there on the 23rd of every month, which is almost a sort of pageant. And they adopted David Bowie almost as a kind of patron saint, as the angel of the outcast, as they called him. And they sang Starman when they dedicated the place to his memory. So it's places like this that I've tried to kind of seek out and sort of bring to people's attention and celebrate in the book.
You also visited many graves and graveyards in Ireland.
Yeah, I did. I think probably my favourite graveyard in the book is Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin. I had never been there before until I went to visit it in connection with this book. And I was absolutely blown away by that place. Just the theatricality of it, you know, the sheer swaggering drama of that place. Never mind the sort of great names that are buried there, just the way it looks in some ways absolutely amazed me. And I was also very struck by how well tended it is. I think that's something that's really happened over the last couple of decades. It has become much better looked after than it used to be. But compared to many of the cemeteries that I was visiting in the UK, I found Glasnevin to be really well looked after. And of course, it has, you know, a cafe and a gift shop and a museum and all those sorts of things there too. So Glasnevin, certainly my favourite of all the graveyards, I think.
Talk to me about the remarkable Phoebe Hessel. She was someone who ended up, she refused to be separated from the man she loved, so she went off and fought alongside him.
Yeah, so Phoebe Hessel is buried in the churchyard of St Nicholas in Brighton, and her remarkable story is laid out in part on her headstone there. Now, Phoebe Hessel lived in the 18th century, and her sweetheart, the story goes, was a soldier in the British Army, and he was being sent off to fight in foreign climes, and she didn't want to be separated from him. So to avoid that, she pretended to be a man and joined up in the army so that she could go alongside him and fight alongside him. And this deception was remarkably successful. And it was only discovered, I think, a few years later, when she was bayoneted on some awful battlefield in Belgium, I think. And the army doctor, kind of rushing to her side, took off her tunic to tend to her wound. And at that point, he saw her body and the game was up, really, and she was discovered. But what I find, what also was remarkable about her is the fact that she had, she joined the army, so she'd involved herself in a profession that might have been expected to end her life rather swiftly, but instead of which she was remarkably long-lived. She lived to the age of 108. So she was born in the reign of Queen Anne, and she lived into the reign of George IV. Just an extraordinary life, and I think a television adaptation waiting to happen.
Wonderful. And finally, you also explore the issue of unmarked graves. And there's a nice Irish connection there where you explore some of the traditions here as well.
Yes. Well, this was the story of the Killeeny graves, which there's a great many of these in Ireland, I believe, about 1,500, they think. The graves of, generally speaking, babies who died before they could be baptised, and therefore in the theology of the time, this meant that they couldn't be laid to rest in consecrated ground. So the parents of these children would often take them and lay their bodies in places where they would be able to go to remember them. So often it would be, say, near the foot of a particular sentinel tree, or very near an old ruined church or something of that sort, where these were places where they could find them again, but also the places in some ways reflected the liminal status of the children themselves. So they were thought to be in limbo rather than heaven or hell, and therefore the places where they were laid to rest were kind of on the threshold as well. They might be on an island, or they might be on the seashore or a cliff top or something of that sort. So I spent some time travelling around with the archaeologist and anthropologist Tony Maguire, and she showed me several of these sites in Ireland, and they're sad places, obviously, but also absolutely fascinating.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. It's called A Tomb with a View: The Stories and Glories of Graveyards. It's published in hardback by Headline and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Peter Ross. And Peter, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book tells the story of Dublin Corporation in the second half of the 19th century, focusing on the visions and conflicts of its members. The book is called The Politics of Dublin Corporation, 1840 to 1900, From Reform to Expansion. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €50. The author is James Murphy. And James, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's a great pleasure. I look forward to talking about the book with you.
So what was the role of Dublin Corporation in this period? Because there wasn't an Irish Parliament. The representation for Dublin Corporation had been increasing during this time. Daniel O'Connell was Lord Mayor at the start of this period. Was there a sense that it was trying to be some kind of civic parliament?
Absolutely. And in the late 1860s in the Corporation, Sir John Grey, who was a prominent member of it and whose statue still stands in O'Connell Street, he spoke of it as having the possibility of being a civic parliament. Now, in fact, it never really lived up to that promise, but it did have that promise at the beginning for a number of reasons. Firstly, it was reformed three times, in fact, during the period that my book covers, around about 1840, again around about 1850, and right at the end of the period in 1900 when my book ends. Before 1840, the corporation, which was the city council, was in the hands of the small self-perpetuating elites and cliques that really still perpetuated what one might call Protestant ascendancy in Dublin. Then there was a reform of Irish municipal corporations. Most of them were abolished, a few were retained, and they were opened up to a new form of voting, to a larger electorate, still a very small electorate compared with the population at large, but one which did allow Catholics to become represented. So that in the early 1840s, in 1841, there was an election, and Daniel O'Connell became Lord Mayor at the end of 1841, and he tried to use the corporation as a sort of a forum where national issues could be debated, where issues such as repeal could be debated. And indeed, early in 1843, he mounted a great debate in the corporation about repeal, and the person speaking against him was the Tory leader in the corporation at the time, Isaac Butt. So it did have that early promise, but it never really lived up to that promise, because there were no consequences for national politics being debated there. The corporation had no real power to affect national issues. So in spite of the promise, it never really lived up to it.
So how good was it then with dealing with the problems that Dublin was facing in this period? Because the city had serious debts, the infrastructure needed an awful lot of work and needed a new water supply. Was the corporation able to look at and deal with these problems?
That is an excellent question. And the answer is that the report card would be a very mixed one. We have to bear in mind that the Victorian period was the great period for municipal government in Britain. In the new industrial cities of Britain, there were many prominent citizens took part in local government and built up great infrastructure. Dublin had a number of problems when it came to that. Firstly, by and large, it wasn't a rich city. It didn't have a large industrial base. It had, as you rightly say, it had great debts. In addition, in the 1840s, though this changed around 1850, there were a number of other self-perpetuating bodies that controlled aspects of life in Dublin, such as the Wide Streets Commission. And so Dublin was at a disadvantage, and its disadvantage increased during the century as whatever wealthier people remained in Dublin, generally Protestant conservatives, they tended to move out of the city. And at that stage, the limits of the city were the two canals. The city was quite small, and these wealthier people tended to move out and to what we might call suburbs. But they established those suburbs as independent townships with their own municipal authorities. So they didn't contribute anything to the finances of the city, whereas they drew on the resources of the city. And you're quite right, there were quite a number of issues facing the corporation during the 19th century. The housing situation was very bad. There was rampant disease in the city. The one issue we remember, of course, is that of the water supply, which ended well, and it preoccupied a political debate in the early 1860s. And there was a large amount of discussion about bringing in a new water supply to Dublin, because prior to that, water had come from the canals and it wasn't in the best sanitary condition. Eventually, a government commission recommended a water supply from the River Dartry, and that was achieved. Again, Sir John Gray on O'Connell Street is the one remembered for bringing that in, but in fact, he didn't work on his own. He worked with two other people in particular, a Tory called Kinahan and a sort of an independent member called Francis Codd. They were the ones responsible for bringing in a new water supply. But equally, there were other issues as well. And the corollary to a water supply is a sewage system, what was called mains drainage. And the debate around that and planning for that dragged on for many decades, from the 1870s onwards, right to the beginning of the 20th century. And it cost a lot of money. Eventually, in the early years of the 20th century, a main drainage system was installed. But there were other achievements too, particularly with the markets. Dublin was the centre for Irish agricultural exports, or for much of Irish agricultural exports. And there were several markets in Smithfield, and the corporation oversaw the creation of new markets, particularly the cattle market on the North Circular Road. So that's part of the balance sheet, which is a very mixed one in a way.
Very mixed one. And I wonder, was a challenge trying to rise above the political and religious divisions of the time? Was it able to do that?
That's another excellent question. The answer is probably not. And it's interesting because the electorate was so small, in some ways, the corporation was out of touch with national politics in Ireland. For much of the century, the two political parties in Dublin were the Tories or Conservatives and the Whigs or Liberals. In the 1840s, Daniel O'Connell with the repeal movement tended to take over the Liberal Party. But after his time, things returned to Whigs or Liberals versus Tories. The Liberals tended to be mostly Catholic, and there was a sort of an underlying sectarianism about it. I think the Tories resented the fact that they no longer controlled the city, and they tried to hold things back. In fact, during the Fenian period and into the early home government period of the 1870s, the corporation was largely unaffected by trends in national politics, which had brought various forms of nationalism to prominence. And in fact, in the 1870s was quite a good period for the corporation, a sort of a cooperative period for it. And really, nationalists didn't bother too much trying to control the corporation during that period. However, in the 1880s, under Parnell, nationalists turned their attention to local government. And famously, the Dublin Corporation came under scrutiny in 1881 when there was a motion to award the freedom of the city to Charles Stuart Parnell and to Dillon, who was one of his lieutenants. And the corporation narrowly voted against that, but that drew nationalist interest in the corporation. And thereafter, nationalists sought to gain seats on the corporation, and they succeeded in doing so. The one of the results of that was that the corporation now came to be controlled from outside, nationalist leaders outside the corporation, as it were, called the shots, particularly an MP called Tim Harrington in the 1880s. So the corporation had an interesting and complex relationship with national politics.
Okay, well, James, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's a brilliant book by one of our leading scholars, James Murphy of Boston College. It's called The Politics of Dublin Corporation, 1840 to 1900, From Reform to Expansion. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €50. The author, as I say, James Murphy. And James, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. On the 1st of November 1920, 18-year-old UCD medical student Kevin Barry was hanged in Dublin's Mountjoy Jail for his role in a bungled IRA operation in which three British soldiers were killed. To this day, he remains a celebrated icon of patriotic, idealistic death, his name synonymous with youthful Republican sacrifice. And on this, the centenary of his death, his story has been retold in a new biography by his grandnephew. The book is called Kevin Barry, An Irish Rebel in Life and Death. It's published in paperback by Merrion Press and costs €16.95. The author is Eunan O'Halpin. And Eunan, thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
Can we begin with your final chapter about a martyr in the family? I wonder what exactly it means for you to have completed this biography of your granduncle, the fact that it's been published in the centenary of his death, and what it was like having this martyr in the family.
Well, there's two things. I think it was the generation after Kevin. I think the children of his siblings who were most, you know, and some of whom are still alive, for whom the anniversary is particularly, the centenary is particularly important, because they saw Kevin through their parents, you know, and through their parents, in some cases, their parents' reluctance, as much as their parents' willingness to talk about his death and so on. And when it comes down another generation to grandnieces and nephews, as it were, I don't think it quite has the same power in relation to Kevin himself, but it does have a lot of power in relation to memories of one's own family and so on. But in terms of family, though, the point I try to make in the book, or one of the points, is the oddity that it was Kevin and Kevin alone about whom we heard. My grandmother, Kitby Barry, his very dominant eldest sister, who curated Kevin's memory very carefully and aggressively at times. But her husband, my grandfather, Jim Maloney, his brother Paddy was killed in May 1921, and there was never a mention of him. So he was killed in action in Tipperary. And so I think it's curious that Kevin became the sort of sole focus of family narrative and of sort of family invocation of the War of Independence and even the Civil War, because my grandparents were very much involved in both. There was no mention at all, for example, of my father's parents, who were, in a sense, exiled, like many Northern Republicans, were exiled in 1922 and had, in some ways, had very hard lives thereafter. It was just all about Kevin, and I thought that's not to belittle Kevin, but it's a peculiarity that I wanted to explore.
And why do you think the story of Kevin Barry has resonated over the past 100 years? Is it the fact that he was 18 years old when he died, the circumstances of the death? What exactly is it?
Well, there's several things. One is that it was coming. In fact, his being sentenced to death, the fact that he's the first volunteer, if you like, or the first rebel since Roger Casement to be sentenced to death and executed, was very important. I think also as a candidate for execution, from the point of view of the British government, they could hardly have chosen a sort of a worse kind of candidate, in the sense that basically, Kevin, first of all, he's a medical student, so he's respectable. He's a Jesuit boy. And the photographs which were in circulation of him were even just before his death, he looks just like a public schoolboy in Britain with that hooped sports shirt. It was almost a rerun of the losses of thousands of lives, of British middle class lives, if you like. I think that's part of the reason internationally why if you like, his fate attracted such interest. I think also the reality was he had been involved in the killing of three ordinary soldiers. I think if he'd been involved in the killing of three officers, the reaction in Britain to his sentencing and to his death would have been quite different. Because I do think we underestimate. We're coming to the centenary, obviously, of Bloody Sunday, and we're coming to the centenary of the Kilmichael ambush. Both of those were reported in Britain as being about the deaths of officers, not about the deaths of ordinary soldiers and so on. And I think there's a kind of a class element to Kevin's story, as well as indeed to that of Terence McSweeney, because McSweeney was portrayed internationally not as the brigadier in charge of Cork No. 1 Brigade of the IRA. He's presented as a civic figure, as the Lord Mayor of Cork. I mean, the king himself in Buckingham Palace was fretting about McSweeney and felt that more should have been done to find a way out rather than to let him die. And that's all to do with, in a sense, to do with status and respectability rather than the particular details of the, of what McSweeney was in jail for or indeed what Kevin did.
There was some controversy a few months ago about whether it was appropriate for a young medical student to be involved in the killing or the taking of any life. What did you think of that?
I thought it was it's very much beside the point. And a lot of UCD medics, young medics, I think more probably than from other faculties proportionately, were involved in the IRA in Dublin in 1920 and 1921. A number of them were out on Bloody Sunday. There's no reason to think that Kevin wouldn't have been out on Bloody Sunday had he still been alive and active. Some of them, like Hugo McNeill, who became Assistant Chief of Staff in the Army afterwards, he had become an assassin in April 1920. He and another man had targeted and shot dead a policeman, a detective, as he went to work. McNeill later commanded the firing squad, which executed the four forecourt leaders in December 1922, and he went on to have a very distinguished military career. Now, he didn't obviously continue in medicine. Dan Bryan, who I knew pretty well in his last years, was out, inverted commas, out on Bloody Sunday, not as a shooter, but as a watcher. He stayed in the military side of things. And didn't complete his studies, but others did. Andy Cooney, who was a very well-known IRA man and who ultimately became briefly chief of staff of the IRA, Cooney went back to his studies and qualified. A lot of them did, and I don't see that what you do in peace and what you do in war are quite different things. I don't think that studying medicine or dentistry or whatever allied subjects where you're trying to help people, it doesn't follow that this means that you can't fight for your country and fight for your cause if you think it's a just cause. And if you think, if necessary, to take life for your cause, that's what soldiers do.
The image of Kevin Barry was always someone who bore his trial with great courage and heroism, and again, the way he faced execution. But that's also backed up in the British records.
Oh, I think it's backed up very much. But I think that the finest account of his last hours isn't the rather syrupy and very Catholic accounts from the prison chaplain, which, you know, are all part of a kind of a highly Catholicised version of Kevin's death. It's from a prison warder who tells a Dublin Castle official, who tells another official who's actually running the propaganda arm, such as it was, of British rule in Ireland. And he says the prisoner Barry talks sport mainly. And he goes on to say that as time went by and there was no sign of a reprieve, the prisoner, quote, remarked somewhat cynically that that only happened in the cinema, which of course is the old American, you know, the old American cinema thing of waiting for the governor's call to see if the execution is going to be stopped. So and the last line of that report is, he went to his death with callous composure. And you couldn't get a better, send a better account for your enemies than that. But I have to say, we also, if we look at McSweeney, who died, you know, courageously, if we look in the Punjab, James Daly, you know, who died sort of not, as it were, famously, and not supported by anyone, but Daly clearly died by the accounts of his own executioners, not only by his comrades in jail. He died, you know, he wanted to face the firing squad. He wrote a very powerful letter to his mother, and so on. So it's you know, I think generally, I mentioned in the book also John Amory, who was executed at the end of 1945, who was a British, a kind of a second-rate Lord Haw Haw, but whose father, Leo, had been Secretary of State for India from 1940 to 45, and was a real Churchill loyalist. But John, who was a ne'er-do-well, had started broadcasting for the Axis, and for this he's executed. And his father's account of John's last days are in some ways very like accounts of Kevin's in that day. His father takes great comfort from the manly way in which John, always for the first time in his life, faces up to what he's done, apologises for being a sort of delinquent son, and says, I'm proud to be your son. You know, I think people find strength in these terrible situations that sometimes nobody realised they had.
You get a great insight from the book into not just Kevin's story, but also the story of so many who went off who got involved in the IRA and in the War of Independence, and many of whom were to lose their life that very month.
Well, that's true, but I think what's also important is, I mean, my own view, if Kevin had been 2 or 3 years older, chances are he'd have been in the British Army, right? Because so many really, would say, still schoolboys from, particularly from the kind of school that Kevin went to, went straight off to the army. Belvedere lost, I think, 48 pupils in the First World War, right? Clongowes, another Jesuit school, lost something like 95. My grandfather, Jim Maloney, I mentioned, his youngest half-brother, because Jim was part of the his mother's second family, Well, you see, he was 21 or something in 1914. So he of course, joined the British Army, although he ended up as a pilot. But this was entirely natural, in a sense, for within families to both relatively well off, educated young men who'd been to secondary school, and obviously people from the thousands of ordinary Dubliners, for example, in the few streams of ears and so on. It was a natural way to go, independently almost of politics.
Okay, well, the book comes highly recommended. I think a perfect Christmas present for our listeners out there, especially if they have someone who is interested in history, or indeed as a present for themselves. The book is called Kevin Barry, An Irish Rebel in Life and Death. It's published in paperback by Merrion Press and costs €16.95. The author is Eunan O'Halpin. And Eunan, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Patrick.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be looking at the importance of mythology to Irish history and preparing for Christmas as we review some of the best new books out there and hopefully giving you some ideas for presents. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.